beans, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, Bohemian Rhapsody, Nobody's Fool, Suspiria, and Beautiful Boy. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news I actually wanted to bring up, and it's not even movie related, but it's horror related. And we just came off of Halloween, and as I've probably bored a lot of people out there with how much I love horror movies and how much I love the horror genre, it is something that has been troubling me when I saw this thing happen. It's about a haunted house that is in Central Ohio, which is where I'm from. It's this place called the Haunted Hoochie, and apparently for years, I've never been there. I've always seen the ads for it and the posters, but it's kind of like at the other side of town. It's a pain to get to. So I've never gone there, but apparently they've been doing for the last 28 years, they have what's called Swastika Saturdays on that last Halloween weekend, that Saturday, and this became kind of an issue, and it hit national prominence because it happened to be the day that there was that the synagogue attack, which was a horrible act of hate and terror. And this is an argument that I've had with a friend in terms of not in dealing with swastikas or Nazism, but the whole discussion of what's shocking and what's dangerous and what's problematic in video and horror movies. And his response a lot of times is, well, it's a horror movie. You can do whatever you want to. You watch something really offensive, like Irreversible, and call that a horror movie rather than a crime thriller or Human Centipede. Or, you know, when they had this whole series of who could be more offensive back about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. And the response is anything that's horror is something that unsettles you. And I agree with that force to a certain degree, but I also think that there's a point where it goes from using scary imagery to endorsing behavior. For example, if, anyone, the greatest horror of anyone's life is something's going to happen horrible to their family. And I think you can make that an element of a horror movie or a thriller. But you shouldn't revel in it. And you shouldn't, like, be on the side of doing horrible things to people's family. And that's the problem with the Swastika Saturday. This is where I see it as a problem is, you know, look, if you've got a Nazi tattoo, I think it's fine in this day and age to say if you have a tattoo of a swastika and it's not part of Captain America punching Hitler in the face, but if you have a swastika as a tattoo, there's a problem. That should not be, you should not be like, oh, you've embroiled yourself with hate imagery. Oh, but that it's naughty and it's dangerous and we're showing the evil side of humanity, but you don't protect the evil side of humanity. And that's why this was a problem and it caused a national outrage. And these people didn't apologize for it or even backpedal on this until like Monday morning or something like that. So, look, I think I'm fair to say, I don't want to have anything to do with you. If you've got a Nazi tattoo, if you're promoting Nazism, if you've got a swastika on you, I'm sorry, that's not what we stand for in this country. Unless it's a swastika on Hitler's chest as he's getting punched in the face by Captain America. The next piece of news I wanted to hit really quick that is about movies is we got a couple development things going on. Ridley Scott is coming out and saying he's going to be doing Gladiator 2. I'm sorry, Ridley, you need to stop. Start making new movies again. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Prometheus. You will find no bigger fan of Prometheus out there than me, and I will defend that movie. But we don't need you to keep retreading your own movies. I thought it was neat bringing in Denis Villeneuve to do Blade Runner as a sequel, but you don't need to be doing sequels to your greatest hits from the last century. And yes, Gladiator was last century. It came out in 2000, which is still technically part of the 20th century. So, you know, Ridley, either retire or do new stuff, but don't mine your greatest hits in your 70s. That's just starting to get sad. Another piece of sad news is Martin Lawrence is confirming to return to Bad Boys 3, which it's been the struggle getting their schedules to sync up, and rather not the it's basically to clear Will Smith's schedule. And then I guess Martin Lawrence, I don't know what he's doing now. He's been out of movies for years. So it's not like it's not like he's got a big production schedule, but we all know that this is going to suck, don't we? Don't we all know that Bad Boys 3 is going to suck? Not just because Michael Bay's not involved in it. As much as I don't like Michael Bay, I think you would need him involved in a Bad Boys movie for it to work, but it's coming out in January 2020, and that's at least the slated release date. And that's never a great time to release a movie. Yes, January movies have done well, but I don't know if this is going to be one of them. And then finally, Tyler Perry is talking about retiring his Madea character in the movie A Madea's Family Funeral, which apparently has already been shot and it's done. It's just waiting for a release date. And she may not be dead in it. She may just be in the movie, but he may just be retiring the character. And that's going to last until he has a mortgage payment due. We're just a couple ex-wives down the road before another series of Madea movies for him to just start paying his bills until he turns into Tyler Perry's Nicolas Cage. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Upside, which stars Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston in a remake of The Untouchables.
All right.
Penthouse.
You need to wait your turn.
Relax, it's not a holdup. Just sign this for me, please.
How would I sign it?
I don't know. Slowly? Well, don't your arms work?
They don't.
You can move your mouth.
As can you. I need assistance.
How much does it pay?
You are not qualified for this position.
The buckle!
You
there?
You as rich as Jay-Z?
No, richer.
This is like I said, it's a remake of a foreign film, and it's about a person being an attendant to a quadriplegic. And it's their story. It's kind of a typical award type movie where you have these unlikely pairing of these two characters, and they get to know each other and they get to like each other and love each other and be friends and deal with stuff. And what this is ostensibly a work relationship. And, you know, this looks actually pretty good. I've never seen the original. I should pull that out. I've got a DVD of it somewhere from an award season a couple years ago. But I'm curious to see Kevin Hart do the little bit more dramatic. And I mean, they're throwing a lot of comedy in this trailer, but I'm wondering if they're just, that's all the comedy that's in there. They just crammed it all in there because Kevin Hart's known for comedy. And then the rest of it's a more serious take. I hope that that's what it is. Or at least he's being a little more generous to Bryan Cranston to have the comedy, which he's done before. So I'm curious about this one. It'll probably be award season film, so I should be able to see it before the new year. The other trailer I want to hit is Spies in Disguise, which opens on September 13th of next year.
Hello, Agent Sterling.
Let the beat drop.
La 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 la.
It worked. Subject appears disoriented.
Oh, Walter, what did you do?
Pigeons are everywhere and nobody notices them. It's the most perfect form a spy could take.
Unbird me right now.
This stars Will Smith as a secret agent who's turned into a pigeon. It looks really bad. Honestly, I don't know what to think about this movie and seeing it. It literally looks like a bad production idea pitch that got realized in its final form, and I mean I don't know, this looks really bad. I'm sorry Will Smith, you're grasping at straws. This could be the worst animated version that you've had since Shark Tale, but we'll see next year. Gotta wait 11 months. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Suspiria and Nobody's Fool.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. And the first one I want to hit is Suspiria. An American dancer attends an elite ballet academy in Berlin in 1977, only to discover a sinister force behind the scenes.
Three mothers. Three God. Three devil. Mother Tenebrarum. Mother Lacrimarum. And Mother Suspiriorum. Darkness. Tears. And sighs.
Some kind of deal with them.
This is a remake of the 1977 film Suspiria, which is directed by Dario Argento, and it's a classic horror movie. It is a cult film, and it's also very polarizing. I personally have never been a huge fan of the original Suspiria. I've seen it multiple times. I've given it plenty of fair chances. And I get why people like it. There's the Goblin soundtrack, which is a fantastic piece of music. And of course, Dario Argento is known for having worked with the band for other films. That's sort of infamous from the 70s and I think into the 80s. I think his last one he did with Goblin was into the 80s. And the dream logic that's involved in the movie where stuff doesn't always quite make sense, and the harsh, very brightly colored lighting, which is parodied in like a movie like The Editor, where it's that unrealistic blues and reds. And I remember when I first saw Suspiria, when I was like in high school. So it was only about 10 years or so, 10, 11, 12 years after the movie had come out. So it wasn't like an old movie at the time. And it just didn't have much of an impact on me because the tagline was the only thing more terrifying than the first 93 minutes is the last seven or something like that. And I didn't find it all that scary. I didn't find it had that red paint blood. And so it just didn't look very authentic to me. But I do see why people like it. And even this year, I rewatched the original Suspiria before I saw this version. So I could keep it fresh in my mind and compare the two. Now, I went and saw Suspiria. And this version differentiates itself almost immediately. It's a muted color movie. It doesn't have those bright, harsh colors that the first film does. It also has a very subtle soundtrack where the original soundtrack is right front and center, and it's very stylized. This one's much more subtle and in the background. And so it's taken some of the elements that make the first movie noticeable, and it's changed them to say, hey, we're doing a different film. And it also doesn't bury the lead about the worry of witches, where I think in the original Suspiria, it takes a while for them to actually say, aha, they're witches. Like literally in the first scene, they bring that up in this movie. Now it takes place in the 70s, so it essentially has the same story of an American student, but the look of the school, it looks like this old German school, this school that had been around since the the building had been around since, World War II. And because it's in Germany and in the 1970s, it takes place in the 1970s, you're still dealing with the next generation coming out of World War II, where the people who survived World War II are older and they're in their senior years. And you have the youth of that day dealing with that and coming up, having grown up after the fact of World War II. There's a lot of the political stuff woven in there, which you don't get in the original movie. The other thing I think that's interesting about it is it has these levels to it. And I'm not speaking on behalf of the original, but this one certainly has levels to it. The kind of movie that you can watch in the theater, you're going to miss a lot of stuff. And now it's a long movie. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes. So it takes a while to watch it. So if you're going to watch it, you're not going to be stampeding to watch it two or three times, but I think it's a movie that you can watch multiple times on video and get more out of it. There's a lot of subtlety. There's a lot of symbolism in there. Not in an annoying way. Not something like Mother, which came out last year, or Mother, which was annoyingly symbolic. It was so obvious that it wasn't a real story. It wasn't representing. It was just sort of putting a card on top of what they're really supposed to be saying. And this one has things that you can dig deeper and find, sort of like The Shining, where in The Shining, you can watch The Shining as a horror movie and be okay with that. But then you can kind of look deeper and find these elements of the movie that are worth studying and breaking apart and dissecting. And I feel Suspiria is like that as well. And It does run a little bit long, but I think it really works as a unique version of the first film. It's not trying to remake that movie. It's not hitting it beat by beat, but it is delivering on the core of what that original movie promises, which is this shocking, disturbing, and unsettling look at this weird little ballet school. And especially when you come into the climax of the movie, it is intense and it is violent and it is bloody. And so it hits all that part. I really enjoyed this movie. I know some people are like, oh, it's overblown and it's, you know, they love the first movie so much that you can't remake it. I don't necessarily think that with this film. I think this is an incredibly well done reimagining of it. It is what needs to be done when you say reimagining of something. So it absolutely works for me. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Nobody's Fool. Two polar opposite sisters must learn to deal with each other as adults to fix their respective lives.
I like sexes from my exes. My sister is a bit much.
How can I help you?
I do what they say.
You've been standing in line all this time and you don't know what you want. Okay, you could just stand right there and think about it.
Who is this?
Charlie. He is an amazing guy. She met him online a year ago, but she's never even seen him.
He seemed too good to be true.
If the man looks too good to be true, he is. You're being catfished.
You know, it's been a couple weeks, so we haven't had a Tiffany Haddish movie in, like 10 days or something. So we have yet another Tiffany Haddish movie. This is a great example of where I had said, I'm thinking she's going to get overexposed too soon. She has a limited shtick. Now, like in The Oath, I thought she played differently. She played a little bit against type. But this is her standard shtick of the fast-talking, loudmouth woman that you saw in Night School and, of course, you saw on Girls Trip. And I guess it works in a limited setting, but I'm watching the trailer because they didn't show this to us because it's a Tyler Perry movie. They never screen Tyler Perry movies. I was accused by somebody who said, oh, he doesn't like anything that involves people of color. And I'm like, well, if they show it to me, I'll certainly give it a fair shake, but Tyler Perry movies are never screened for critics now. And I wasn't expecting this movie to be screened for critics. So I'm not going to lie to you. This is going to get a preemptive suck because it was not presented to me at all. So I didn't get a chance to see it, but I like Tika Sumpter. I think she's a beautiful woman and has a great acting ability, but she always ends up playing second fiddle to somebody. And she's used a lot in Tyler Perry's movies, but I think she's underutilized. Tiffany Haddish, though, I think her shtick is getting old, and it's getting tiring to see the same character in a movie, and I think she's going to burn through her opportunities so quickly because this is like the fifth movie she's done this year. And I guess this looks like it might have some laughs to it, but they're going to be Tyler Perry laughs, which mean that they're not that good. They're going to be overly morose and they could have been redeveloped. But I guess it has an audience. Who knows? There's no Madea in this movie because I don't know. She's at a funeral. So in the end, I still have to say Nobody's Fool gets a preemptive suck because there is no attempt whatsoever to show it to anybody.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Nutcracker and the Four Realms and Bohemian Rhapsody. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Let's talk about The Nutcracker and the Four Realms. This Disney production tells an alternative tale of the Nutcracker, in which a young girl must save a magical world from enemy invaders.
Where am I?
You're in the Four Realms, Princess Clara.
Princess?
Welcome to our world. The land of snowflakes. The land of flowers. And the land of sweets. But in the Fourth Realm, this is where our troubles began. Mother Ginger started this war.
Don't you know it's dangerous here?
I hope you'll be the one to finish it.
This is a sequel, pseudo-sequel to the ballet production, which in itself is based on a story. It reminds me a little bit of Alice in Wonderland, the Alice in Wonderland Tim Burton movie that Disney did, because that wasn't Alice in Wonderland. That was like Alice returning to Wonderland. And that's kind of what this is. And it's not the original girl who goes to the Nutcracker realm, but it's her daughter, Clara, who goes there, and she encounters all the characters that we know, the Sugar Plum Fairies, of course, the Sugar Plum played by Keira Knightley, and you've got the Nutcracker, and you've got the Mouse King, and you've got Helen Mirren playing this mysterious woman in the woods who seems to be getting ready to attack their realm. So it relies on pre-existing knowledge of the Nutcracker to actually kind of make sense of it. I mean, I guess if you don't know anything about the Nutcracker at all, if you just know it as a Christmas performance that you've never seen, it explains it well enough, but it has all those little bits and pieces where, oh, look, there's the toy soldiers, and there's this, and there's that. So, you know, if you're familiar and seen the Nutcracker, which I've seen the performance a couple times, the original Nutcracker, the ballet, the first half is very plot heavy. It's a story of them getting the toys and the toys coming to life and then going into this realm. And then the last act, the second act, is a bunch of dance numbers. And I mean, they're great dance numbers, and it's a way to show different music and different cultures, but there's really no story. They just travel from realm to realm to realm to realm and see a different ballet. And that's because it's a ballet. That's what it's meant to be. And I think that's why they didn't just do a direct adaptation of it. They wanted to make it something a little bit more. Probably so they didn't end up in the middle of the movie going, oh, crap, we have no more story left and we still got an hour of the movie. So I think in that sense, this works. And the story itself's not great. I mean, it's a little thin and it's not terribly plot heavy. It's a bit of a MacGuffin just to get there. The story is just, it's about them going kind of almost on a scavenger hunt, going from place to place to place to get things. And the characters aren't terribly well developed, but that's okay, because in its essence, it's really just a fairy tale. And it's an excuse to get people in the seats to see this incredibly opulent production, which is visually gorgeous and stimulating and has just some wonderful imagery in it. And that's where I say it's similar to Alice in Wonderland, because when she goes to the Nutcracker realm, although it doesn't have that creepy look that Tim Burton tends to put in his movies, it is very visually extravagant and beautiful, and the production design is gorgeous in this movie. Even in the real world, you know, it's like it's Christmas, and it's just a beautiful sort of London in the 1800s, sort of this Dickens-esque look of it. It reminds me, in the beginning of it, it starts off with this flyby of London, and it reminds me a lot of the motion capture Christmas Carol movie that Robert Zemeckis did. Oh gosh, it's over 10 years, maybe 10 years ago, less than 10 years ago, that came out. And that also came out right at the beginning of November. And that's where it reminds me of what it looks like, a Christmas card. And it's just beautifully composed. The acting's, they got a decent cast to it. Keira Knightley kind of oversells her Sugar Plum Fairy goofiness. Almost, she's almost like Bernadette from The Big Bang Theory. And there's some other nice little cameos and people in the film, and Helen Mirren's great in it. Mackenzie Foy plays Clara, and actually she holds her own pretty well in the film. I don't think she's given as much to handle as she could. Like I said, the character development in the story is a little bit thin, but that's not why you see this movie. It feels like something you'd watch at Christmas with a family, and it absolutely works. It's just that it's really early. It's the first weekend in November. So still, I'm going to have to say the Nutcracker of the Four Realms kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Bohemian Rhapsody. This musical biopic follows the career of Freddie Mercury and his involvement in the classic rock band Queen.
So now what?
This is when the operatic section comes in.
The operatic section, yeah.
Mamma mia, mamma mia.
Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. For me. For me.
Goes on forever, 6 bloody minutes.
I pity your wife if you think 6 minutes is forever.
We will rock you.
I was originally interested when I heard Sacha Baron Cohen was going to be playing Freddie Mercury, and they were actually getting ready to do this, but he ended up not doing it. He ended up exiting the project, and they had a different director, and they brought in Ben Whishaw, I think, at one point was going to play Freddie Mercury, and now it's Rami Malek, who most people recognize from Mr. Robot. And I got to give Malek credit. He really becomes the character. He does a great job as Freddie Mercury. I mean, I think he really embodies that larger-than-life stage persona that Freddie Mercury had and brings it to the big screen. And the only problem is he's just not tall enough. That's like the only issue on a physicality standpoint. But I think they shoot around that a lot, because Freddie Mercury was, I think he was like, you know, like what, 7'2" or something like that. But it works as a movie, and it's not a Freddie Mercury biopic necessarily. It's a Queen biopic, because it starts in 1970 when the band has their genesis, the group gets together, and it goes through the Live Aid concert in 1985. And that's not the entirety of Freddie Mercury's life. There's more before and after, but that's the bulk of the involvement with Queen. That's the bulk of the movie. The other thing is, when you have a biopic like this, there are certain beats that all seem to be the same. Let's face it, you throw enough money and drugs and women and men at a narcissistic rock star, you're going to get the same result each time. And I remember when Ray came out, what, almost 15 years ago? That was a great movie. And then they did Walk the Line like a year or two later. And it really felt like you're watching the same movie, only with just a different artist in it. And that's because these movies kind of hit all the same points. I actually talked about that with A Star Is Born a couple weeks ago, because even though that was a fictional account, it just kind of hit all those same points. This one comes at it slightly differently. So it doesn't feel like you've seen this movie a dozen times before. And that's kind of good, especially coming out in the wake of A Star Is Born, which does follow the musician biopic process, only it's a fictional story. And I think that's because they focus on the music. This is not necessarily about Freddie Mercury's life, but he's heavily involved because he was heavily involved in Queen. He was heavily involved in making these songs. And it shows what the band went through and how the band worked together to make some of the greatest hits on the planet, rather than just watching somebody's downfall and spiral. And yeah, you have those moments. And yeah, you have the breakup where he moves out and does his own solo stuff. And of course, you know, you have that, because that exists in the framework of the movie and the framework of Queen with their music. But by making it about the music, it's not about the people necessarily. They're just performers of the music, and it's important to know what they were going through. So there's certainly plenty of personal moments with Freddie Mercury and the other characters. But yeah, and I've heard some of the complaints is that they skimp on certain details. Like they skimp on, you know, the whole issue of him having AIDS at the end of his life. But the movie's not about him dying, and it's not about AIDS. It's about the music. And that's what makes this movie work. And so I'm going to have to say, I thought this was a great film, and it really makes you feel like you're part of the movement that Queen started in the 70s. So I'm going to have to say that Bohemian Rhapsody totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I'm going to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Beautiful Boy, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Other Side of the Moon.
I'm a rocket ship on my way to Mars on a collision course. I am a satellite. I'm out of control. I'm a sex machine ready to reload like an atom bomb.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Beautiful Boy. Steve Carell plays a father desperately trying to help his drug-addicted son get his life back.
There are moments that I look at him, this kid that I raised, who I thought I knew inside and out, and I wonder who he is.
I thought we were close. I thought we were closer than most fathers and sons. Why?
I felt better than I ever had, so I just kept on doing it.
This isn't us. This is not who we are. My son is out there somewhere, and I don't know what he's doing. I don't know how to help him.
You can't.
Every year, it seems, actors like Steve Carell have their award film pick. any kind of hot A-list actor always has something coming out around award season that they want people to get. Now, Steve Carell has two. He's got this one and Welcome to Merwin coming out, I think, next month or later this month. I think even today, people still pigeonhole Steve Carell as a comic actor because he's very funny and he's great in The Office and he's great in a bunch of the movies he's done. But he's a good dramatic actor and he's had his turns in drama. He dipped his toe in it a little bit with movies like Little Miss Sunshine and The Way, Way Back, kind of first breaking out of the comedic role, but he's done some pretty deadly serious stuff like Foxcatcher. He was fantastic and disturbing in Foxcatcher. So it's great to see him continuing on with dramatic roles. And this one's, I think, one of his most less sensational dramatic roles because he's just a guy. He's a guy who's got a son and he's trying to help his son. It's not an entertaining movie, but it's an issue-driven movie, and it's an issue that's important to everybody because drug addiction, like meth addiction and opioid addiction, that stuff's just not happening in bad neighborhoods, man. That's happening down the road from everybody. It's literally where I live down the road was there was something that happened, an issue with that, and we live in a good neighborhood. And I have a friend who's dealing with a very similar situation that's going on in Beautiful Boy. It's heartbreaking. And the problem that there is, and this movie spotlights it, is no matter how much you want to help somebody, no matter how much of a position you're in to help somebody, you can have as much money as possible to pay for rehab and to help them out and to give them a place to stay. You can't make a drug addict get better. The drug addict has to not just want to get better, but have such a dominant desire to get better that has to overcome every desire to slip and have a relapse. And that's very, very difficult. That's what's devastating about this. And it's his son. And what do you do when you can't help somebody? It really doubles down on the feeling of hopelessness and helplessness that this guy's having in trying to wrap his brain around the problem, figure out what's going on, figure out what he can do. And, you know, and realizing that there's only so much you can do if the addict doesn't necessarily want the help right now. Very well portrayed by Steve Carell, but also Timothy Chalamet does a great job in here. Watch these two through award season. I think this one's going to get some nominations. And it's a good movie. It's definitely worth checking out. And I'm going to have to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, Halloween had another good weekend, which makes sense. You know, Halloween was going to do well in its second weekend anyways, because it's Halloween. I think you're going to see a drop off this week because, you know, Halloween's over. I think there were a lot of people who wanted to go see Halloween on Halloween weekend. And that's why it made like, what, $31 million. And A Star Is Born was the next closest with less than half of that, like $14 million. Hunter Killer didn't even make $7 million. And then obviously, as we talked about last week, there's good reason for that. Johnny English Strikes Again didn't even get into the top 10. It made $1.6 million. But again, I don't think anyone was expecting that. I mean, Johnny English Reborn, like I said, that didn't crack $10 million. These movies make money in Europe and overseas. Goosebumps 2 had a nice little run last weekend again because it's a Halloween-themed movie. Those are going to trickle out really quickly. Halloween movies have a very short shelf life, and that's a shame, but it's all made up when it comes time for video, because a lot of people like to rewatch stuff when it comes time for home video. I rewatched the original Halloween while I was sorting through Halloween candy, so hey, that all works. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week is sort of an alternative piece that's getting a new release, and that is The Other Side of the Wind. It is the last film that Orson Welles did, and he started shooting it in 1970. I think the production went all the way through 1976 for various reasons, for reshoots and such. And it's one of those infamous films that never got finished, never got released. He eventually died in the 80s, and heirs successors in interest, we'll say, who struggled with trying to bring the film back to fruition, but he was like banging the girl who was in the movie, and she somehow had a claim to this, and she was like a producer and a writer, even though she was essentially his Yoko Ono. where he's putting her in all of her movies. Basically, like what happened with Citizen Kane. In Citizen Kane, he falls in love with an actress and puts her in stuff, and she never ends up becoming a famous person. That's exactly what happens with this movie. So The Other Side of the Wind never got finished in the 70s, and it kind of languished for decades. And finally, Frank Marshall and Netflix came in and said, hey, we're going to finish this movie. And they finished it, and it now is available on the streaming service, but it's also getting a theatrical release. So Netflix is releasing the infamous unfinished film of Orson Welles about a director trying to make a comeback in the 1970s during the turbulent Hollywood era.
I just want to know what he represents.
The man is infested with disciples. I'm the apostle.
Just like me and God, how could you tell us apart?
Patrick's new movie?
The Other Side of the Wind.
What's that about the movie?
We don't talk about the movie.
So you old guys are trying to get with it. Is that what this movie's about?
Well, we don't actually know.
What do we know? Jake is just making it up as he goes along.
This movie is a great example of a director who is sort of making a movie about his own self-fulfilling prophecy. He kind of did that with Citizen Kane, where he became this young director who made his opus at such a young age and became so famous and never lived up to it again, and then falls in love with a actress, as we talked about, and tries to make her a star, and that doesn't quite work. And that's essentially what Orson Welles did in his life with this actress in this movie. But also, this movie's about a guy who was in self-imposed exile. He's played by John Huston and comes back to make a new movie. But at the time he's making it, it's during the transition in Hollywood from the old studio system to the 70s, where you had more maverick directors and more experimental filmmaking, and blockbusters weren't quite there yet because you hadn't had Jaws show up in 1975 and then the follow-up of Star Wars in 1977. So like the new studio system with blockbusters hadn't quite taken off yet, and the old studio system had gone. And so there was a real transition going on in Hollywood, and this movie does pay homage to that. It does pay lip service to that because it was done at that time. It's historical now because it's almost 50 years later. But by making this movie at the time, it's a snapshot of kind of what Hollywood was like back then. The problem is it's very much for Hollywood a navel-gazing movie. It's about how important they are and how insightful they are, and it shows them having their parties and their esoteric discussions and the behind the scenes. And one of the reasons I've always had a dislike of watching movies about the behind the scenes of Hollywood is because the behind the scenes of Hollywood is kind of sleazy. And you can have a very likable character on screen, but the people who are either making the characters or playing the characters or creating the characters aren't necessarily all that likable in real life. And the people, the players and the movers and shakers, they're arrogant and they're self-absorbed, and it's a very pretentious industry if you start dealing with the actual people there. And that's what this movie brings across. And I guess there's a realism there because you got like Peter Bogdanovich playing a version of himself. But he's an absolute D-bag. He's like, oh, I'm so important. And he's unappealing. It's got a great cast. You know, like John Huston plays the director, but even he's a real sleazebag hitting on this like 17-year-old girl serving drinks. I mean, it's just, look, I mean, if you're a huge fan of old Hollywood, it's definitely worth seeing. If you're a huge fan of Orson Welles, it's definitely worth seeing to see where his career went. I wouldn't necessarily call it a movie to see in a vacuum, because if you're young or you don't really understand the significance of this in cinematic history, it's just going to be a boring movie. And that's unfortunately because, it's such a legendary film that never got finished, and now it's gotten finished. And then you're just kind of looking at it going, oh, it's not that good. So I'm going to have to say The Other Side of the Wind kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Also releasing this week, we have The Spy Who Dumped Me, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, Slender Man, and The Darkest Minds. Now I need to go. That's it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Grinch, The Girl in the Spider's Web, and Overlord. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.